Hello everybody, welcome to the lecture 5 of this course. I just want to remind everyone that next week, we normally have a lecture would be scheduled for next Thursday, but I'm going to be away at Mises U next week, so the lecture 6 in the course won't be next Thursday, it'll be the Thursday after that. Now, you remember last week when I was talking about Locke, I said there was an exception to what I had been doing in the course so far, that when we were talking about Plato, Aristotle, and Hobbes, they were basically, certainly possibly Aristotle, some of them accepted, but not even him, they were basically not ones you could view it as all as precursors of libertarianism. They were on the whole on the statist side. And last week, we had an exception. We were talking about Locke, and I argued that Locke is someone who can be seen as having a libertarian theory, not fully, but he was certainly tending in that direction. We can get a libertarian view very easily from what he was saying in the second treatise. Now, today, we're going to be going back to the pattern that we had in the first part of the course. The thing that we're talking about today, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, was definitely not a libertarian. In fact, it's been argued by some writers, such as the Israeli historian Jacob Talman, that Rousseau is really one of the ancestors of modern totalitarianism. That's a controversial thesis. But if you don't go along with that, he was certainly no libertarian. Now, before we get to Rousseau, I want to just say a little bit more about following up on what I was saying last week about Locke. Remember, when I was talking about Locke and describing his political theory, I was mainly concentrated almost entirely on Locke's second treatise on government. You remember I was mentioning the controversy over when the treatises were written. It used to be thought that the treatises came out right after the Glorious Revolution, 1688. In fact, they were written substantially earlier. But the book that everybody talks about is the second treatise. But what about the first treatise, which is a very long book? It's not read very much. I just want to say, what was in that? Well, the first treatise is a reply to a book called Patriarcha, which was had been reissued a few years before Locke was writing, but it had actually been written about 40 years before, I think in the 1640s, by Robert Filmer, Sir Robert Filmer. And Sir Robert Filmer was defending absolute monarchy. And so what Locke was doing was replying to Filmer's arguments against absolute monarchy. Now Locke was very cautious about acknowledging that he wrote the first treatise. One reason for that was one person earlier had written a reply to Filmer, Algernon Sidney, and Sidney was executed. Now, he wasn't executed for writing that reply to Filmer, but it did show, give some indication, you had to be careful what you were doing if you attacked Filmer. So Locke was, in any given, a kind of cautious person. Now, what Filmer said was, if you look at the Bible, you'll see that Adam was the ultimate source of political authority because he was the ruler of the original family. He was the first ruler. And then political power, according to Filmer, passes down from Adam to his descendants, of course, who remember wouldn't go through Cain, who slew Abel, it goes through his son Seth. And then, according to Filmer, you can go from Adam, you can trace a line of descent down to the absolute monarchs of today, or at the time he was writing. So he said, well, the justification for political authority is that it ultimately stems from Adam. This is what the Bible says, and if you go against that, you're going against the word of God. Now, Locke took this very seriously as he went through the Bible trying to refute Filmer. And basically, he had his reputation with really two principal arguments. He said, well, the authority that the Adam or the head of a family has over family isn't the same as political authority, because in a family, the members of the family are bound together by mutual affection. The parents love the children and they're trying to bring them up. But in political authority, it's more of an impersonal relationship. So even if it's right, even if Homer is right that Adam had authority over the family, that's not the source of political authority. And Locke said the Bible doesn't claim that it is. Now, another criticism, and this would be kind of one that I'm sure would have obviously occurred to people, is you can't really trace a line of descent from Adam to the present king. You could construct fanciful genealogies, but you couldn't show, say, for example, the Stuart monarchs if England had descended from Adam. I might think that's, well, kind of completely so, but there's an analogous problem we find in Locke's own political account of how property is acquired, because those, remember, Locke holds that you acquire property by mixing your labor with it, and then once property is originally acquired, then it can be passed down to the owner's heir. So there's a problem then, how can we show that the heirs, the people who now have the property, are the legitimate heirs of those who first acquired it? Do they have to come up with a, they have to be able to trace the genealogy to some act of initial acquisition, or don't they? Murray Rothbard's approach was, no, you don't have to. If you're in possession, that's taken presumptive evidence you're a legitimate owner, and if people want to challenge that, then they have to come up with evidence that you're not. But it is interesting that there's kind of a parallel there with Locke's criticism of Filmer on this argument, possibly something we could ask about his own theory of property. So now I want to turn to subject of today's lecture, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who lived from 1712 to 1778. Now, one thing about Rousseau is different from the people I've talked about so far. When I talked about the other political theorists, in most cases, although I don't think I did this very much with Plato, I gave some account of their life a little bit, but before Rousseau, the writers I mentioned before Rousseau really didn't write about their own lives very much. They had various doctrines, they were trying to promote. They would write about them, and sometimes you would get personal details about their life from their writings or what other people had said about them, like that John Aldrich had stories about Hobbes. But people don't write about their own lives very much. St. Augustine did, but that was very rare. But Rousseau was very much concerned with his own life. He wrote about his own life a lot in the Confessions and various other books, and Reveries of a Solitary Walker was another book by him. So he stressed his own consciousness very much, and he wrote about it, and this became very influential on the 19th century Romantic movement throughout Europe. He was born in Geneva, which city in Switzerland, but at the time it was a largely self-governing Swiss state, so it wasn't completely independent from other cities in Switzerland, but it was largely self-governing, something like the city-state in the ancient Greek world. And the fact that he was born in Geneva was very important to him. He very often would refer to this, and he remembered when he was a little boy, he had gone with his father to various public festivals in Geneva, and he put in his later work, in the Social Contract, a lot of stress on the importance of public festivals, such as something like in the United States we have 4th of July parades, and where everybody goes out and watches the parade. So this would be something like that. We have people going out in public and celebrating their living together in a public body. Now, one of the laws of Geneva was Catholics couldn't be citizens. So Rousseau, for a period, converted to Catholicism under the influence of a lady he met, Madame de Warenne, who had a great influence on him for a while. They were romantically involved. So when he converted to Catholicism, he lost his citizenship, and this really bothered him. Sometimes he would still call himself a citizen of Geneva, even though he wasn't entitled to legally. But he got his citizenship back when he renounced Catholicism. Now, after he lived in Geneva, he went to Paris, and he became friends with some of the great intellectuals of the French Enlightenment, like Denis Diderot and Voltaire, the great essayist, historian, and satirist. But he later broke with Voltaire, and when the Social Contract came out, Voltaire made fun of Rousseau. Now, when on one occasion Rousseau was taking a long walk on the way to visit Diderot, this was in 1749, and he had a vision. It was something like he just was resting and he had this tremendous vision. And after he had this vision, he wrote two short books we'll be discussing a little later called Discourses on the Arts and Sciences and the Discourse on Inequality. So that was the first major work. And while at the same time, he was not just someone who was writing on political theory, he had a lot of things that he was doing. He was a musician, he wrote operas, and he invented a new system of musical notation that wasn't used that much, but it was his own idea. And he also wrote a very popular novel, so he was very productive. Then he later wrote The Social Contract, which is considered one of the key works in political philosophy, and also what I mentioned before, the concessions that inaugurating the trend in very influential literature where the writer is interested in his own personality, is describing his own personality as something to write on. Previously, people didn't do that very much. St. Augustine was an exception. People really didn't write about themselves too much. And that sounds like enough for at least a couple lifetimes. And Rousseau was also a noted botanist. He was very good at collecting specimens of plants. He was one of the leading botanists of his time. Now I want to go into what Rousseau said in the two discourses that I mentioned. Rousseau rejected one of the basic principles of economics, the benefits of the division of labor. Now, those of you who are familiar with Austrian economics, maybe you've taken courses by people, or even my course, Mises Academy of Economics, will know about the division of labor. And what division of labor is supposing you have to produce everything you need to live by yourself, it would be very difficult, if not impossible. Say, you have to grow your own food and build your own house. People just don't have all the skills to do that. And how would they possibly do everything they need to live just on their own? If people tried to do that where they were totally self-sufficient, then very few people could survive. And one thing you get especially is if you look at Mises' Human Action, he points out that the division of labor, social cooperation through the free market, makes it possible for people to live much better than they would if they just had to do everything by themselves. Because instead of each of us can specialize in what we're good at, and then we can engage in peaceful exchanges with other people. So if you look at things from the perspective of Austrian economics, from the perspective of Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, you'll see the division of labor is really one of the key principles of civilization. We really couldn't exist without the division of labor. We'd be in a very bad way. I certainly couldn't. I can't even cook anything. How could I possibly live if I had to produce all my own food? I wouldn't know what to do. But with division of labor, I can give lectures such as this and I get money for this. You wouldn't believe it, but I do. And so then I can go out and buy things that I need. Now you think, well, wouldn't everybody say, isn't this one of the great ideas, once they realize division of labor is really essential for civilization? But Rousseau didn't agree with this. Seems like the argument's pretty obvious that Rousseau said, no, this isn't right. That he thought people were much happier before the division of labor. So division of labor had made people unhappy. People were really better off in primitive society before the division of labor had developed. Things were really better in the Stone Age, or at least at some period in the far distant past. Now, you might say, look, this is pretty stupid because in the way I just explained, we really couldn't live without the division of labor. I mean, don't we get all sorts of goods and services with division of labor that we wouldn't have if we just had to produce everything for ourselves? Rousseau himself wouldn't have been writing operas or writing his books if we didn't have division of labor. So how could he possibly say that? Well, he didn't deny that division of labor brings more goods and services. He said, sure, that's right, but while it does that, while it's bringing all these goods and services, it also increases the number of desires you have, because you say, well, here are all these things available, there's so much more that I want. So people become very dissatisfied. If you have to produce everything for yourself, then you may not have very much in the way of material goods, but at least you won't have all these unsatisfied desires. Now, this point actually is one of the classic themes of opposition to the free market. So you find it in the 20th century in the work of the American economist James Kenneth Galbraith, who said, well, okay, you have all these advertisers who are just creating these artificial desires in people for goods they really don't need. So this is a line of thought that I don't know that Galbraith took it from, so he has somewhat of an ancestry in Rousseau. So the thought is division of labor and the profusion of goods that we have on the free market will just get people to have all these desires for things they don't really need. It'll just make people happy. Now, a further point that Rousseau made when he was attacking the division of labor was he said, well, in a developed economy, like say that of France of his own time or even more of the US state, you're dependent on other people. This is basic in the division of labor, just as I said before. I couldn't produce my own food or build my own house, so I'm dependent on other people. If I were self-sufficient, maybe I wouldn't be able to produce much, but I wouldn't be dependent on other people. And the type of dependence he had in mind was not just physical dependence, that I need other people to, say, produce the food that I need, or if I get sick, I need to go to the doctor, I can't cure myself. He had a special mind, a psychological dependence. And he said, everybody naturally cares about himself or herself. You care about what your own welfare, what you're doing, how this amour de soi, self-love. But he said, with the division of labor, we're also dependent on the opinion that other people have of us. We call this amour propre. You see, I have atrocious French pronunciation. But what this means is, so we're not just concerned with our own well-being, but we care what other people think of us. Now, what's wrong with that? Suppose I say, well, I care, I want people in this class to have a good opinion of me, so what's wrong with that? He said, well, that leads to insincerity, because if I care about people's opinions, I won't present my real feelings unless I think, I'll just try to present the feelings I think other people will think well of me if I have those. So people become two-faced. I'll say, well, I'll be an example. Suppose I say, I think people in this class want to hear a libertarian message, so even if I weren't a libertarian, I present myself as one just because that's what I think people want to hear. So if I did that, I'm not doing that. But of course, you say, well, I'm not lying about that. But if I did that, I'd be insincere, because I'd be just expressing a certain view just because I think you will think better of me if I have those views. So I'd be two-faced if I were doing that. And Rousseau thought, like, might say, well, how does he know that people aren't just giving their true opinions? Maybe they think that people will like their true opinion, so they don't have to be insecure. Or as is the case, I am a libertarian, so I think you'll like libertarianism, so I'm giving you my true opinion. But Rousseau didn't think that. He thought that most people are insincere. They're just trying to put on a mask that they think that, so they can present themselves in a way that they think other people will approve of. So the division of labor leads to insincerity. And there's a book I should I can get the title for you, but you can look it up under the author's name, Sean Starobinsky. He has a good book on the notion of transparency in Rousseau. Rousseau thought people shouldn't be deceptively two-faced. You should be able to know from talking to someone what he or she is really thinking. So division of labor interfered with the necessary, but Rousseau thought was very desirable quality of society being transparent. So Rousseau, as I just said, is very critical of insincerity and division of labor. So then he says in these two discourses, well, what enables us to have this insincerity and division of labor? How do you get division of labor started? And I think he says quite correctly, and Mises would agree with him, that you need private property for division of labor. If you have a collective trying to own anything, it won't work out very well. Or a division of labor, you need private property. So Rousseau, going to say, remember, Rousseau doesn't like division of labor, says it leads to insincerity and it leads to all these people having all these desires for things they don't really need and get very unhappy because they have unsatisfying desires. So he's very much very critical of private property, and he said the person who first fenced off land, said this is mine, was a great criminal. So you might think, well, if he says, if he's contrasting, says, well, look, things are really bad with division of labor, and people have all these unsatisfying desires, how can he say that? Because wouldn't it be the case that primitive people, he can say that, that's the incorrect term, but people before modern civilization developed, didn't they have very hard lives, so they wouldn't be doing very well at all? But what Rousseau didn't think that, he had a speculative anthropology, and the way he pictured it was people started off largely solitary, so we have people who basically living by themselves. They sometimes meet each other, but people basically live alone. And people were compassionate. If you saw one of the other people suffering, you would try to help them. So people started off as basically solitary, but also compassionate. And in this state of affairs, people were happy, but they weren't very well developed intellectually. And in fact, one of the great historian ideas who lived in the late 19th or 20th century, Arthur O. Lovejoy, the founder of the Journal of History Ideas, he suggested what Rousseau was really talking about, the kind of a state before human beings had fully evolved. It was sort of a higher, he was talking about the higher apes here rather than full-scale human beings, but that's controversial. Now you might think, well, this is just completely crazy, he's just postulating some kind of ideal utopia, a utopia, just putting it back in the past. And I should say there's a lot of evidence that that view is right. There are many anthropologists say, oh, no, society in those days was very warlike and people were always killing each other and fighting. Steven Pinker has, I think, a book on tracing the history of violence where he said that, with other anthropologists, Robert Edgerton, and you were coming to primitive society was really not very happy at all. So there is one influential anthropologist, Marshall Solins, who thinks Rousseau was pretty largely right. I might be saying this just because he himself is somewhat influenced by Rousseau and somewhat of an idealist. I should just mention, that if sort of on Rousseau's side, if you think that Rousseau is viewed as completely implausible, I'm inclined to agree, but I should say there is at least this one influential anthropologist, I think he's retired from the University of Chicago, Solins and his school, think Rousseau is basically correct. Now, you might think, well, if Rousseau thought that things were really better before the division of labor, it is his view that we should just try to get rid of division of labor. Maybe we should just go back to this kind of idyllic, primitive life, just get rid of it, and we get rid of all this desires that in his view we don't really need, and we could all be sincere and compassionate again. But what he says is, well, no, we can't do this. In the first place, even if he was right, in spite of whatever, even if he was right about how good things were in these primitive conditions, only a very few people could live in those conditions. If the population increases, then we need a more organized life. And he doesn't object to that, but he says, well, it was private property that ruined things. But he still doesn't say, well, we should just eliminate private property completely. And just say, get rid of the arts and science and go back to a primitive state, because I think very few people could be supported. And in any case, once our intellectual powers have developed, we really can't go back, even if we tried. Because remember, I said in this state where Rousseau is thinking all the primitive people were happy, they also aren't very well developed intellectually. So once we do develop intellectually, we can't just say, oh, well, we're going to junk things and just go back and live in a much simpler way. He doesn't think we can do that. So his view is the progress of civilization has been one from a happy state to an unhappy state, but we can't go back to a happy state. It's just too late. We just can't do it. It's just like it's a parallel, say, in the biblical story of the Garden of Eden. Things were better then, but we just can't go back there. We just can't do it. So, what can we do? Well, and this is something that Rousseau addressed in his main work on political theory, social contract. He said, can we somehow justify this transition to civilized life? Rousseau has painted civilized life in a kind of bad light. He said, look, we need civilized life. People are insincere. They have all these desires for things. So what can we do? So he says, well, in order to justify this transition, we have to come up with a political system where people give up their freedom to the common or general will, that kind of the collective bodies consisting of everybody. So we all give up our freedom to the collective general will. And remember, in Locke's account, everybody surrenders his or her right to enforce the law of nature with the common will, to the whole body of the people, but you still retain your individual rights. You're just giving up your right to enforce the law of nature. But in Rousseau's system, everyone is giving up all of this freedom to the whole body of the people, but when we're doing this, we're still as free as we were before. So this is quite a paradox. is each of us is giving up his or her freedom, but we're still as free as before. So one of the key things we have to ask when we're studying self-contract is, does Rousseau succeed in resolving this paradox? If you're giving up your freedom, how can you still be as free as before? And we'll be looking at, is he successful in this attempt not to, I don't want to keep you in suspense, I don't think he was, but he has interesting things to say. Now, before he gives his own account of political authority and social contract, he attacks other theories, competing theories. Like one is that this will remind you of what I said about Locke on Sir Robert Filmer. His attack on the derivation of political authority from family authority is like Locke's. He points out, just as Locke did, that family authority, unlike political authority, is motivated by affection. So what you would hold in the family isn't a good basis for trying to establish what holds in politics. Then he criticizes Thomas Hobbes. He had been a very close student of Hobbes' Leviathan. But remember, in Hobbes' political theory, people are motivated by fear of violent death. In the state of nature, anyone can have the power to kill anybody else. You're always in fear of other people, and you then surrender your arms. Everybody surrenders its arms to the sovereign, so it can exit the state of nature. So what Rousseau objected to that, he says, well, Hobbes, when he talks about human nature, he's treating this as if it's a constant, that people are always in fear of violent death. This is just a kind of natural characteristic of people. But Rousseau takes a view, people really don't have a nature in the sense of some properties or that they have that's always the same, that doesn't vary with the history. In Rousseau's view, people really are influenced a great deal by the social conditions, type of society they're living under. So if people are hostile, that's only because they're living in certain kinds of social conditions. If the conditions have changed this, then they wouldn't be hostile. So this is actually, again, this has been extremely influential on certain strains of the contemporary or 20th century left views that stress the importance of the environment. If only people would live in a, we'll say, a less competitive society, people would have all sorts of desirable social traits. People don't have instincts that make them hostile. This is just comes about because of certain social conditions. This is, as I say, a very influential view. Now, one theme that's come up before in this course is, remember I've talked about Leo Strauss, the German writer who spent much of his life in the U.S., who had his own views on history of political thought. And he and his followers have their own interpretations that are interesting but always controversial of the great political thinkers. And their view, it's always stressing, remember, they'll say these writers have a secret or esoteric message. So what they appear to be saying is not their real message. Usually a person is a secret atheist. Everybody is a secret atheist. So their view of Rousseau was, even though Rousseau professes to be against Hobbes, he's really a secret Hobbesian. They think that that's true of Locke, too. And there's one Straussian writer, Hillel Gilden, who has a book on social contract, where he gives that interpretation. It's not one I hold myself, but you should be aware of that sort of interpretation. So now we've given, I gave what Rousseau criticisms of Hobbes and criticisms of the authorities, such as the family has criticisms of other views like that of Hugo Grotius. But now we're going to go into his own solution. Remember what we're trying to do. He said everybody's surrendering to this kind of collective body. You're surrendering all your rights and liberties to everyone else. So it sounds like you're in a pretty bad way. Say I gave up all my rights and liberties. Doesn't sound like I'm going to be doing very well. But Rousseau wants to say, no, if you do this, you're as free as before. And why, how can Rousseau say that? He says, well, if you all surrendered to everybody else, then the community will decide everything by everyone's having the same will, kind of in a way that I'll explain shortly. People vote on various general laws, and then everyone accepts the verdict. They say, you have a vote, should we have such and such a general law? And then if it passes, even those who are in the minority now accept the same verdict. So we all have the same will, and so then we're free because we're doing what we collectively want. So you surrendered to the collective body, but you now accept the will of the collective body, so you're free because you're doing what you want, namely to accept the will the will of the collective. So people in Rousseau's view are better off than before because if everybody is acting together, no one is subject to anybody else. Supposing, I'm subject to my boss. My boss can tell me what to do. So this particular person has power over me. But in the way Rousseau is thinking, everybody's acting together because people voted, then we have the verdict, now everybody accepts the verdict. So I think Rousseau is making a quite dubious move here because he's thinking that being subjected to others means being subjected to the will of a particular person. But he thinks if you're just subjected to the will of a collective body, then you're really free because there isn't any particular person who's telling you what to do. It's just this is the way the collective body has voted. So if you obey that, you're not subject to the will of somebody else. You're being subject to everybody's will, which includes your will. Now there's some people who have that view even today. For example, sometimes people will defend conscription. The conscription means that you can be drafted into the armed forces, so you have to go into the army if you don't want to. So if people say, well, that slavery, they'll say no because you're not being subject to a particular master. People have democratically voted to have conscription, so then that doesn't really make you unfree. So it's kind of the same move. We're saying you're not subject to the will of someone in particular, so therefore you're just subject to the collective body, so then you're free. And I think that's a quite dubious move. Now, Rousseau could say, well, but look, everybody's willing the same thing. So it's not that you're being forced by the collective to do something you don't want. You're willing what you yourself want. But then he has the problem, why would he think that everybody would will the same thing? And one point he makes is the general will is limited to general laws. It isn't trying to regulate everything. So it would be very implausible to say, well, we'd all agree, say, on what the proper food should be. Wouldn't that be ridiculous if people thought we all agree? We know we all have all sorts of different preferences for things. Yeah, people have different tastes in music and food and art and what kind of houses they like and what clothes they like and so on. So Rousseau doesn't think we'll all agree on preferences for everything, but he thinks if we just consider certain kinds of general laws, then we will agree on these laws. And then we could just push the question back, why does he think that? Why would everybody agree on the same laws? Well, he says, for this kind of agreement that everybody agrees on the same laws, people have to be in the right frame of mind. If they're thinking properly, then they will agree on the same laws. And what he has in mind in particular here is that people can't be influenced by groups or factions. So when you're voting on these general laws, you can't, say, form a club to group that's advancing special interests. So supposing, say, you couldn't form your own libertarian group and just talk among your fellow libertarians and favor certain measures, you'd have to vote on the general laws just as an individual. Now, you might think, well, what's so great about that? You know, if you're voting as an individual, wouldn't just depend on how, whether the individuals have good judgment, but if people just aren't very good at judging the effects of these general laws. So couldn't the general will come up with a lot of bad laws possibly? Rousseau said no, because if people make mistakes, they'll tend to cancel out. Say some people will make mistakes in a certain direction, but there'll be others make mistakes in the opposite wrong way. So if you add up everybody's vote, remember everybody's voting in a separate individual, he thinks mistakes will tend to cancel out and people will come up with good verdicts on the general law. Now, supposing Rousseau is right about that, this and that doesn't seem all that plausible, how would it show that everybody supports the verdict of the general will? Because remember, if people are voting, there's some people who are in the minority, so even if the verdict it turns out to be right, how can you say that the one who voted in minority really supporting the general will? So Rousseau would say, well, we're all deciding as a collective body, so we're all free because we're doing what we decide on, what we want. But what about the people who voted in the minority? They didn't want the law, they voted against it. So his answer to this is, again, the paradoxical one. He said, if you were in the minority, then what you really wanted was what the majority voted. That was, you just thought you wanted the minority vote, but what you really wanted is what the majority voted. So in a famous phrase, he says, you can be forced to be free. It means you can be forced to obey the general will because that's what you really want. You might think you want something else, but what you really want is what the general will has decided. Now, you might say, well, how could Rousseau think that? How can you say something like, say, suppose we had a law that said that people could be drafted into the army, and I vote against this, I don't want this. how could you say that I really want that? I just voted against it. So there's a 20th century philosopher, H.A. Pritchard, a very good critic, and he discussed in, you can get this, book he had that they called Moral Obligations Collection of Ethics. He discussed an argument by the British 9th century philosopher T.H. Green, somewhat based on Rousseau, in discussing this view that we can say people really want what they'll say they don't want. So you could say even if you voted against something, you really want it. So what Pritchard said is sometimes morality requires us to act against our self-interest. Suppose you thought, I can hold this view, but some people do, suppose you thought you really ought to sacrifice yourself for the state by enlisting in the army, but you don't want to do it. So you have a conflict in morality and self-interest. Of course, if you're an objectivist, you would very much not take that view and say, you know, altruism is bad, you shouldn't sacrifice yourself for the state. But I'm not saying you should, I'm just giving this as a view that some people hold. So according to Pritchard, people say there's a conflict between morality and self-interest and how they propose to resolve that. So Pritchard said he doesn't accept this view. So some people think the way to resolve the conflict is to take people to be part of the same entity. So on this view, when you say you really want the verdict of the general will, even though you voted against it, it's just you would be literally part of this collective entity, the general will. And it's just sort of a, when you say you don't want it, your consciousness is just not the real, is not really the, it's just a part of this whole body. So it's something like if you say you're conscious, you don't want it. It would be something like say, well, my arm doesn't want something, but that wouldn't give what your whole body wants. It would just be a part of, it would just be part of the body would be wanting something. So he would take, in this view, the individual consciousness is just part of the collective body. So the real you is the collective body, and that's what won the majority verdict. So in this view, you want what the collective, the general will decide, because the general will is the real you, along with everyone else, is identical to the general will, and so are you, so that's what you really want. I think you could say, without him going to the spur, that isn't a very plausible view. We certainly seem like separate individuals, not just part of some collective body, they're not part of some higher consciousness. Now there's a more plausible interpretation, I think, of this view. There's you can really want what you say you don't want or what you say you don't want. You're given by another philosopher, Grand Blanchard, in a book called Reason and Goodness, he has a chapter on the real will. And he says, well, we all want what's rational. We all want to go according to reason. Sometimes we act against reason, but this isn't what we really want. So if it turns out what's rational is what the general will dictates, then we all want what the general will dictates. So he isn't saying we're all parts of a single self. He says we all want what's rational. And the example of this would be, suppose you have someone who's a heavy smoker and he's aware that smoking is very bad for your health, it'll give you all sorts of diseases. So on this you would say, well, the smoker really wants to act in accord with, reason, and reason would probably say whatever pleasure you get from smoking is outweighed by the health risk, so you really don't want to smoke. I don't endorse that argument. That would be the argument. So rationality requires you to do something, and you really want to be rational, so that's what you want. Now, one problem with that argument is, suppose I find out that rationality requires something, I could drop the premise that I want to be rational. Suppose the smoker finds out it would be rational to give up smoking, and says, the argument is, well, I want to be rational, therefore I really want to give up smoking. You say, well, no, I don't want to be rational. I'd rather smoke if that's what rationality requires to get upon that. And further, if you accept, this argument, so you're saying, okay, I want to be rational, and this is what rationality requires, I really want that. There's a definite sense in which you don't want what the general rule requires, namely you voted against it. So there are problems with this way of looking at this notion that you can really want something that you don't appear to want to say you're against it. But I think at least that interpretation is better than the argument that Pritchard thought that T.H. Green was getting for all. Parts of the same collective cells were all identical. And we can look at this, even the objection I didn't really say, well, isn't there a sense that even except this rationality argument, say, well, I really want to do what the general rule says because that's what rationality requires, but still you still have your individual desires that are going against what the general rule requires. So really don't want it in some kind of very obvious sense. In a famous essay by the great 19th century French classical, Swiss classical literary Benjamin Constant, on the liberty of the ancients and the moderns, he contrasted an ancient idea defining the Greek city-state that we're all part of the same, we're all stressing that we're acting together as part of some collective body, so this is characteristic of the ancient notion of kind of public spirit. The modern liberty stressed more the importance of individuals acting on their own autonomously, not simply as part of some kind of public entity. Now, how would Rousseau deal with this objection? Namely, that if you say, well, I want what rationality is what the general will decide on, what if you kept being outvoted? Say your majority is voted, you're always in the minority, so could you still say, well, I'm doing what I'm as free as I was before I surrendered everything to the general. If it turned out I always have to conform my will to the way I didn't want, I voted the other way. So again, Rousseau gives this point I mentioned before. He says, well, you're not dependent on other people, you're dependent on everybody. Wrongly thought. This meant you weren't dependent at all because you're just dependent on the collective body. As I mentioned, I covered this before, so I'm just going to go over quickly. People sometimes defending conscription say, well, this isn't slavery because everybody's voted on it. You have your chance to vote for it. But it would seem like that isn't very plausible because you're still enslaved in that you have to go into the army even if you had a vote. Say people vote to like imagine something like this. You're all in a room and people say, well, we vote, say you're 20 people in the room, including you. People say, well, we voted 19-1 that you should be a slave or the rest of us. It probably wouldn't make you feel better to say, well, you had a vote in it. So just because you were voting, or just because a collective body decided things, that wouldn't make you free. Although Rousseau certainly thought so, and people agreed with him. Now, Rousseau might have another interpretation. Remember, he says, you're as free as you were before. He might just mean that in the state of nature, the four people surrendered all their rights and duties generally. Well, people weren't very free, so then this claim wouldn't amount to much because they weren't very free to begin with. So if they're as free as they were before, that isn't saying very much. And if you took them that way, that would rather support the Straussian view, secret Hobbesian, that he would be saying the state of nature is really a bad state of affairs, so we're better off if we can get out of it. Now, one thing about the general will, I mentioned before, is very important, is general will doesn't handle the day-to-day affairs of government. It's just voting on general laws and regulations. And the government, the general will chooses the government. So the collective body chooses the government to handle day-to-day affairs. And you might think because of his stress on majority voting in the collective will, in general will, that he would favor democracy as the best form of government, but he doesn't. He says this is suitable only for small societies, and for large societies, an elective aristocracy is the best form of government. Now, there's one question we've left so far unanswered. Remember, the general will, everybody's voting on these general laws, but who gives people the general laws to vote on? That would actually be a very big person, a group who did that would have a lot of power because they would be setting the agenda that the collective body is voting on. And here he invokes what he calls a legislator, who's a genius from outside society who proposes laws to society and generally votes on them. He gives an example of a legislature like Lycurgus, who's the legendary king and founder of Sparta, and also Moses in the Old Testament takes the example. The legislator is a superman proposing laws for the collective body to vote on. And he may have thought that his own books would play this role, that people would study his books and then get some idea of the general laws they should vote on. Now, in order for the general will to operate as he wanted, society had to be fairly small. It wouldn't work if you had, say, a big country like the United States today. We couldn't really imagine everybody getting together and voting on these general laws. Maybe we could with modern technology and internet voting. But he didn't think of that. He just thought society should be fairly small. And he looked back to the Greek city-states as models. And remember, for general will to operate properly, people have to avoid getting into these parties and factions. And to do that, make sure people weren't influenced by bad ideas, education had to be carefully regulated. And like Plato, who was very influenced by Plato, remember, in the Republic and in the laws, Plato favors censorship of the arts, and so did also. And in a letter to D'Alembert, one of the leading French Enlightenment intellectuals, he calls for regulations of drama and music he defended the institutions of his own city, Geneva, in censorship. Now, another thing we need to have, that Rousseau talks about, it's very important in society, is religion. In the ancient world, remember this usually is modern, he says the gods were closely tied to the city. So each city would have its own gods. They were often very similar to gods of other cities, but each city would have its own gods. The religious worship is very closely related to patriotism for the city. His interpretation was quite similar to that of a 19th century historian, Poussin de Coulanges, who wrote a famous book on the ancient city. He was influenced by Rousseau in a very influential way of looking at ancient Greek religion as tied to the city. Now, you might think that Rousseau would say, well, if the ancient city is a model, then we should go back to Greek idea of religion where the gods are bound to the city. But he doesn't do it. He says, well, polytheism, the view that there are many gods, it isn't true, so we can't go back to the Greek religion, just isn't true. And he also rejects what I call a mild version of Christianity, something like when I was talking about Christianity, Locke said, it's enough if you believe that Jesus is the Messiah, that makes you a Christian. So Rousseau said, well, what's wrong with that is that it separates religion from political life. So what he wants is that religion, just like in the ancient city, should be very closely tied to political life, but we can't do that by just going back to what the Greeks did, because that would involve a false view of polytheism. So what he comes up with is what he calls a civil religion. He says this should consist of a few articles of faith that everybody has to accept. And these articles include belief in God and immortal souls. Now, why do we have to believe in immortal souls? That after you die, your soul goes on. Because this is, he thinks that people have to believe this, because this helps make people moral if you think that God is going to punish you for doing bad things, that will encourage you to behave in the right way. Now, if you accept these articles of religion, you can hold more detailed views on your own things, that believe in Jesus, the Messiah, to hold other views if you want. But you have to be tolerant of other religions. Suppose you said that if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell. That wouldn't be allowed, because if you say other people are inferior or in a bad state, and they'll accept the civil religion. Now, what happens if you don't agree to the civil religion? So, well, then they can admonish you and say, okay, I'll agree with the civil religion now. If you didn't, you could just be kicked out of the society. Suppose you said, okay, I agree with it, and then you acted against the civil religion, then you could be executed. This is actually taking this proposal from something like it in Plato's Law. So it isn't, even though we're sort of talking about tolerance, it isn't really tolerant at all for those who reject the civil religion. Now, the last thing I think I want to talk about is what Rousseau said about private property. Now, remember, as you would expect, he's critical of private property. Remember, his view was private property is what makes the division of labor possible. Division of labor isn't all that good a thing. It has bad qualities. But he doesn't want to get rid of private property altogether. In fact, in an article on political economy, encyclopedias, fairly favorable to private property, but he's usually more critical. In his usual position on private property, you can have some private property, but it's very dangerous if you have too much, because then that'll lead to large inequalities, and this will interfere with the operation of general will. Okay, well, I've gone, as usual, I'm afraid I've gone a little bit over, so what I think I'll do now is go to the Q&A box, and I'll leave the chat open also so you can either type your question in the Q&A or ask me something in the chat. Okay, I see we have several already. Now, so these are a list of the first 10 books in order to be read, to read about Austrian economics, politics, and war. Well, that's a good question, but I think maybe I can try to answer that later. I think we'll better to keep the questions just on the subject of the lecture day. Did you watch the TV show Lost? If so, what are your thoughts on how to integrate the character with the namesake Lottie, so etc. Well, I'm afraid I didn't watch that show, so I really couldn't answer that. Maybe I wasn't even aware of the TV series. I don't keep up with TV all that much, but it sounds like an interesting show. Now, another one is, what are your thoughts on discourse on inequality? What are the ramifications of work through history? Well, the criticism Rousseau gave of civilization, you wouldn't think it sounds pretty implausible from the way I was presenting it, but it has been extremely influential. You can find, especially if you look, say, at the one theme in Marxist writing, and they're talking about alienation, this is same sort of view that the market is really distorting the personalities of people that were depending on others, were just producing, not producing works as a whole, and were apart from our true personalities, were insincere. So the view has been quite influential, say, reflecting certain strains of Marxism, and they find it in the Romantic movement in the 19th century. And on the whole, I think the discourses had a quite harmful influence. A lot of people that have taken this idea. You find this in the 20th century, you had one in the works of Norman O. Brown and Herbert Marcuse. You have kind of idea that civilization has its costs and things were really perhaps better before civilization. Now, Malcolm says, did you so think that insincerity did not exist in society without division of labor, without to what did you so think society would evolve to people who kind of got such a program? But I think he thought that really, I don't know that he would be committed to saying there couldn't be insincerity without division of labor, and thought that was the main institution that had promoted such insincerity. And I think he would think if you just tried to get rid of division of labor now, it would have disastrous consequences. People just couldn't survive. So he didn't favor that. He just thought what we should realize is we can't get out of division of labor, we can't go back, but we should realize the cost of evolving where we arrived at. Now, Roger said, did Rousseau lay the foundation for Marx? Well, there are certain themes in Rousseau, like this one that I just mentioned, the criticism of division of labor that you find in Marx. Now, there's some question, Marx didn't write that much about Rousseau, he didn't mention and he's not all that favorable to him, but how much he was influenced by. There's an Italian philosopher in Marx's Giovanni della Volpe, who wrote on Rousseau and Marx, and he was one who thought that there was a strong element of Rousseau and Marx, and he viewed Marxism as the continuation of some of the doctrines of Rousseau, and he was very much in favor of that. To other extent, Rousseau had a very strong influence on the political philosophy of Immanuel Kant. described here. It's a pretty important figure. One question, George, why do few follow the Shastras in minority contributors in sources like that? Why is Shastra not popular? On the face of it, present a claim that several major past philosophers of the crimes of law or accuracy of the atheist appear very dubious. Well, I think one thing is, I think you're right, it very often strikes one as an odd interpretation, but Strauss was very ingenious and kind of, I think people enjoy the traction of the puzzling things out the way he wrote, and so they say, well, here was a secret meaning for things, he would have very intricate arguments for them. So this attracts some people, and they want to study him. He's definitely a minority view, but I mean, there are people who go into that. But, I mean, certainly somebody worth reading. I mean, I guess if you read his books, you'll see some of the attraction. But you might look at Murray Rothbard had some essays, a few reviews of Strauss. I think it give you both some of the good and bad points in Strauss. Now, another one from Malcolm. To what extent did you so influence Marx and also the commune in the 60s and early 70s in the U.S.? I talked about Marx already. he did, I think there was some influence on the communes in something. They were very much in a sort of thinking kind of primitivism. There was a very influential book by the American, early in the 20th century, an American literary historian, Irving Babbitt, called Rousseau and Romanticism. Babbitt was a teacher at T.S. Eliot at Harvard. And Babbitt stressed that Rousseau's emotionalism and emphasis on the feelings rather than reason was very influential on later literature and politics. And I think we could see this in the hippie and commune movement. Now, Bob said, did Rousseau influence Hegel through his own Superman view of himself? Well, I don't know that. I think Rousseau had quite a bit of influence on Hegel. Judith Schlar, S-H-K-L-A-R, who was a very good historian of political thought at Harvard, had written on Rousseau and Hegel. I think Hegel certainly read Rousseau and some of his views on development of consciousness and phenomenology of mind is influenced by Rousseau. And so I think there was some influence there. There are various writers who've written about that, Robert Pippin, Frederick Newhouse, who've written on Hegel, showing influence of Rousseau. So I think you're right there. Now, George says, what is the general argument that Irving Babbitt has against you? So could you please sort of describe some also put in context with Babbitt's worldview? Well, I talked a little bit about Babbitt, but what he was basically, he thought he believed in the importance of the intellect ruling over the emotion. And so he liked classical literature. He said, in the Romantic movement, there's one where the emotions that were stressed and they overwhelmed reason, thought this was very bad. We saw this in the French Revolution, that people were just let loose, they were just driven to irrational political moves because they lost the proper centering of something. It's also influenced by Buddhism and Hindu ideas that this we should just stress the importance of reason and contemplation rather than be influenced by emotion. And he wrote a book called Democracy and Leadership, where he thought that popular passion needed to be guided by those influenced by reason. he had some affinities with the views of Jean Morin in France. He was also a great promoter of classicism and emotion. But Morin took that in the direction of the fascist policy that Babbitt didn't. There's a whole school of interpretation France at the time who saw the source of irrationalism in Rousseau, so that the one that Babbitt is quite influential. And I see there's something in the, let me just go to the chat here. Leslie says, how much did Kant understand Rousseau's political thought? General rule of violence, Kant's structure that every man should be in himself and not in himself. Well, Kant was read Rousseau very closely, and I don't think Kant wouldn't have agreed that Rousseau's general rule uses people as an end. He would have said, no, this is somewhat like what Kant called it, a kingdom of ends, where we're all forming a community, where we're all trying to legislate according to the categorical imperative. So I don't think he would have accepted the view you're suggesting that the general rule may be. I think you're probably right that that is what the general rule would amount to, but I don't think that Kant would have accepted that. Unless we ask another one here, I've read that Rousseau's image of a general rule is that Swiss farmers in a mountain community sitting in an oak tree making decisions for the those people who disagree would go along with the community decision. Well, I think you're right, he was very influenced, as I mentioned, electrifying his own early life growing up in Geneva. So the notion of a community coming to some kind of consensus would have been what in a kind of small community. I think you're right, that would have been one that would be quite influential with him. Oh, now, here's one. Matthew asks you, I've often heard libertarians about man's point of view is everywhere in shame. As Rousseau did not put forth libertarian views, why the correct context? Well, this is in the social contract. He said man's point of view is everywhere in shame. He said, well, how did this come about? He says, can one justify? He says, I think I can. So he's going to say, he's not saying, well, we should just break loose and everybody should be, just do whatever you want. He says, well, I can justify the process by which we're all subject to an authority if it turns out the authority is this collective body or the general will. Now you'll find there's a book came out in the 20th century by William A. Dunning of Columbia, kind of the history of political theory, actually discusses this quotation and what it means. I know Ralph Raichel thinks very highly of Dunning, so that would be a good one to look for there on that quote, on the interpretation of that quotation. Here's one. Roger says, what would you so think of Hugh's mind-wave democracy? Well, I don't think he'd approve me. He'd think a large democracy would not be able to be governed by the general will. In fact, one writer, Bertrand Juvenel, who may some of you know, Ethics of Redistribution, there's a book. He was very much devoted to Rousseau, and he stressed what Rousseau emphasize that the community should be small. You see this also, and Rousseau wrote a constitution for the Kingdom of Corsica. You say, you know, you can see this. I think Malcolm, what are your thoughts on Rousseau's discourse on inequality, what is your implications for which I think I already answered that one. You have that one before. So I think that one we've already covered. mean, now here's one. Jurors is interesting, and so criticize the influence of people handling each other in division of labor, not when those influences when people happen collectively through statism, former influences are largely less systematic and intense than the latter in a person. That's a very good point, I think you make. Remember, Rousseau thinking when the individuals are voting to determine general will, you're voting by yourself, you're not supposed to be talking to other people or having discussions. So each person is trying to determine the general will just by his own deliberations rather than get what other people are saying. Of course, I think in practice it would be very hard to avoid being influenced by others, but Rousseau was very much opposed to factions or parties. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, unless someone has some last-minute question. But remember, next week we won't be meeting. It'll be the week after that. So I see just one. Somebody has a question here. Bob says, "What was the relationship between Rousseau and the French Revolution?" Well, that's a much disputed question. Remember, Robespierre said he was the great, one of the great figures of him, that he was very much influenced by Rousseau, and many of the people against the French Revolution ascribe a lot of influence to Rousseau, but that's very much disputed. There's some people who say, no, it was just primarily French Revolution, to be explained, primarily through various social movements at the time, but it's a very disputed question. I think he certainly had some influence on the Jacobins and other people in the revolution, but that's a very disputed question. Well, all right, thanks everybody. So, thanks for coming to my lecture. Hope to see you again in 2 weeks from today. Thanks a lot. All right. Thank you, everybody. Okay, see you all later.